on. So apparently this will be recorded. I assume you all hear me reasonably well. So it's always interesting and actually useful to me to present material regarding computer graphics to people who know mathematics an awful lot better than I do. I'll try to get this on a film. There we are. Okay. So what I'd like to do is to take you through a few things regarding computer graphics and the way we use mathematics. I'll motivate some of the issues before talking about triangular meshes and so on. So I'm going to go top down and talk a little bit about what we do in computer graphics and how we use really the mathematical sciences, and then motivate perhaps a slightly more detailed analysis of polygonal meshes, just to give you a flavor for some of the mathematics that we do or don't do particularly well. It's fair to say that for the longest time, computer graphics really has been a net importer of ideas in terms of what we need to do to actually get where we want to go. So what do we actually want to do? Well, what we want to do is create visual depictions. We want to listen to what users, visually creative people, want to do, and we generally panic when we first hear that, because typically they want to do either extremely creative things for which we have absolutely no technical apparatus, or they want to do simulations for which we have no tractable way to compute them. So that's for your first impression. And then they want to work with all of these things completely interactively and in real time. So putting all those things together normally causes sheer panic until you actually can get to the point where you can simplify the problem enough that people become happy with your results. And typically we're making compromises somewhere along the way. Typically it's with interactivity. And in fact, one of the things that's become clear is that the user demands for the realism of the depictions, for the manipulability of the depictions, has increased probably with the advent of things like video games. It's remarkable how quickly some things can be computed and how slowly other things can be computed. So one of the things, in fact, that I'm going to get to in this talk is how, in fact, infeasible most of the signal theoretic concepts I'll be talking about later actually are. But they motivate at least some good ideas. So from a top level, we import an awful lot of interesting and important mathematics and mathematical sciences into computer graphics on a case-by-case basis, which means, as a consequence, we don't necessarily fully understand what we're doing when we're importing that. We don't even always understand the assumptions that are being made for an appropriate theorem to be exploited. In other words, we just bulldoze our way through. But the upside of it is that we actually import and do, I think, fairly creative things with some of these, I guess I'll call them fundamental technologies or sciences. And only more recently, I think it's fair to say that computer science and computer graphics have been exporting technology and results to the outside world. In computer science in general, and in computer graphics, we're exporting to areas such as bioinformatics and in scientific visualization and so on. Really, it's fair to say that most of our attention has been devoted to solving problems kind of within the information technology world for the last 20 or so years. And it's only been the last three or four in which there seems to be some tantalizing promise that we're actually going elsewhere. So I'd like to first give you an idea of how and why these kinds of methods, techniques, theories, and so on apply to computer graphics. And I'll just do it by a very simple example that you can't see because of the light. This image is actually part of an animation that was created many years ago. If you look really carefully, you can see a little smoke ring moving from the cigarette. If you look really carefully, you'll see it reflected, in fact, in the ashtray. And if you look really carefully, you'll see it in the shadow down here. Now, the goal is in this was not really to show a smoking cigarette, since that's obviously politically incorrect at this stage, but it's more to demonstrate what really was an interest, has been an interest of mine for many years, namely the modeling, the interactive modeling of turbulent phenomena. And the mechanisms that can be used to actually interactively move the smoke around. I didn't include an MPEG in this presentation, but this does move. So to actually make this stuff happen, we need to come up with models that look an awful lot like some of these systems that you may have seen before. Essentially, the smoke is an instance of a computational fluid dynamics problem. We have to simplify it tremendously in order to get it to work interactively. So we normally transform it into something into a fairly sparse kind of system that can be animated. Because the important part of this is that, in fact, you're seeing a single frame, but a single frame to visually creative people is actually very uninteresting. They want to interact with a moving world. So we have an instance of a CFD problem. We have to come up with a model for wind that moves smoke particles around. We have to come up with models for the geometry. We have to figure out how to render that. We know how to do this kind of ray tracing stuff very well, but in the earlier days, we had no idea really how to efficiently implement multiple scattering phenomena with light shining through, light essentially propagating through a participating medium. So there's an endless variety of techniques that we pull in from the physical sciences, and then we have to make them somehow computationally feasible. This is not a physically accurate picture. This isn't either. This is some work we've done in the modeling of fire. Now, in doing this, it's not physically accurate because we actually don't care about the temperature of that fire, except insofar as the light intensities that are created, or the irradiance of energy in the visible spectrum. Now, this particular image, again, it's not really that easy to see because we've got a lot of participating light in here, but this is a fully self-illuminated image. The fire is casting light in itself. There are shadows being created. The fire is burning as a result of some combustible material below, and there's smoke being produced above, and so on. So we have, to model this, we have a set of coupled processes that allow one to compute things like heat exchange, combustion, propagation of heat, and so on in the environment. And ultimately, again, that is secondary to producing an image. So if someone wanted to come up with a quick hack of, 10 lines of Java code that did this, we'd jump on it. It would be, it's an Occam's razor approach. The fact is, though, to create consistent, plausible models, it would appear that we have to do what most scientists have done in the past, and that's to construct good, mathematically tractable models that can be reduced to something that's computationally feasible. So once you have something that is potentially physically realistic, you can then be fanciful and do all sorts of interesting things that are not really realizable. In this particular image and the animation that it came from, what we were really interested in was capturing things like interesting wisps of smoke, that kind of thing, which required, as it turns out, some very interesting signal processing to ensure that the fine wisps were actually being rendered appropriately. So that's really to give you a feel for the fact that there's a lot of interchange, a lot of exchange among models, a lot of different aspects of the physical sciences and the mathematical sciences that enter into this. When I started research in this area 20-some-odd years ago, I had no clue what kind of mathematics I would actually need to know to be successful in the field. And so when students ask me how should they be prepared, it's hard to say anything other than get a very broad education in every area you can think of, because sooner or later it would appear that everything is relevant. My biggest shortfall was, in fact, that I didn't take a cinematography course and I didn't take a good fine art course. I took enough math to get by, it turns out. I was just lucky. So those are sort of physical phenomena that I'm really interested in. I've done a lot of work in that field. I'd like to talk a little bit now about shape and then move toward polygonal models. The mathematics of shape, in fact, is probably one of the more kind of crystalline and well-traversed areas in computer graphics insofar as the use of basic and fundamental mathematics. The most typical representation, I decided not to write it all out in math, the most typical representation of shape for continuous surfaces is to have some set of discrete data points. Sometimes they're points to be interpolated, sometimes they're points to be sort of approximated. and take those databases, wrap some basis functions next to them, and do a superposition of all those things. And under the right circumstances, you get a surface. Under other circumstances, you get a volume. And in some cases, what you have to do is solve a system to get the surface. For example, a so-called implicit function, or a system made of implicit functions, the definition of surfaces through level sets, is only got by solving for a particular isosurface. So you can get actually an infinite class of surfaces depending on a variety of parameters or scalar parameters that one might set. So the first two points, the notion of free-form surfaces and the notion of implicit functions, are very traditional, and I think most people who take a multivariate calculus course in second year would understand more or less what at least the specification of these surfaces is like. There is another approach that has really beguiled people in applied mathematics and computer science, namely the notion of a subdivision surface. That's been around for about 20 years, and it kind of reached its zenith about 3 or 4 years ago, and the research has tailed off just a bit in the last couple of years. And the idea there is start with something that you know and love, say a polygonal representation of something, and specify a mechanism for subdividing those polygons, perhaps adding a little displacement, subdividing the polygons, then looking at each of those subdivided polygons and further subdividing. Under the right circumstances, you actually proceed fairly quickly, as it turns out, to a limit surface through this notion of iterated subdivision. And it's been very tantalizing because from a user perspective, you're often dealing with a relatively small number of initial polygons to work with, and they completely determine the surface that you're defining. So the idea is, you know, how can you do a lot with a little? Well, if you start with a little and pull on some of these polygons or the vertices making up the polygons, you've got a nice kind of clean, efficient way to at least specify a wide variety of surfaces. So all of these techniques give you ways of specifying continuous surfaces. The problem really is that the mathematics we do here in the first three cases has to be reconciled to user expectations. Most users aren't mathematicians or physicists or computer scientists. And moreover, the specification of shape is only part of their workflow. They're interested in a wide variety of things. They're usually interested in some design problem. So to give you an example, one of the prime drivers of all of these computer-aided geometric design approaches has been the automotive industry. Now, in that space, some extremely adept and creative people first design shape by making some doodles on post-it notes or something like that. But what ultimately they're interested in, and you'll notice right away the moment you look at a car ad, is they're interested in the reflection lines along the side of the car. Anytime you open up a nice color glossy in car and drive or something like that, you'll notice that, for one thing, the car is always at an angle to you. Right? Most typically, the front of the car is to your left, and it proceeds this way. It can proceed this way, but it's remarkable. So there's almost a language of car presentation. And in fact, when they first start designing cars, it's really done from the perspective of how it's going to look in a glossy photo. So what are the things they're looking for in that situation? Certainly, they're looking at they need three-dimensional models somewhere and shapes to design that look. But they also need to presume what the paints are going to look like, what the curvatures are going to be like under certain illuminations to give you the reflection lines that will define uniquely the brand of that vehicle. So the mere definition of C2 continuous functions across some surface is only a starting point for the end result. And what is getting very interesting in computer graphics, and really more generally the manufacturing process, is how you can tighten up the loop between that initial design of things like surfaces to actually applying paint and doing the illumination all in one workflow, so that you can, in fact, potentially work backwards from a reflection line. So that would be pretty neat. You actually draw a reflection line, and you invert the design process to come up with a shape that, under certain illumination conditions, gives you that nice glossy line. That's where things are going. I'm going to talk mostly about the forward problem because that's what this stuff is all about. I just wanted to indicate, though, that there is a real problem between reconciling really the mathematical models we use to the user, I should say, user workflow expectations. They expect to work in a larger setting. Now, all that said, those were kind of higher order and interesting surfaces, but for some reason, the lowly polygon, in other words, a small set of vertices in space connected by some line segments, seems to be what everyone's using now. So I want to talk about why that's the case first, and maybe talk about why we might want to look at a more mathematical treatment of these objects. So the polygon is extremely simple. The triangle is about as simple as you can get and actually cover some space. A line segment doesn't really do us much good in today's world. So when we talk about polygons, we're really actually talking about triangles because you can break anything up into triangles. Now, one of the things, by the way, that's interesting with graphics is that polygons usually are thought to be planar. But in graphics, sometimes you'll get non-planar polygons, and those are kind of fun to work with. So in any case, polygons are really common. Everything that I mentioned earlier, all of these kinds of surfaces are likely to be broken up into millions of polygons to be rendered. Because of their simplicity, they actually are easy to render, so that they form kind of a connection between higher order surfaces and the rendering engines that we know about and that you can buy for $50 now. When I started in this field, by the way, the rasterizing frame buffers used to cost $250,000. The same technology and then some can be had for $25 or $30 now. It's a remarkable progress in the technology. So monitors alone used to cost $15,000 to $20,000. It's just, you know, just really very simple monitors, and now you can get them for $500. So polygons form kind of a primitive rendering primitive. They tend to be a bit of a normal form for higher order geometry in the sense that everything can be transformed in a piecewise way to them. And probably the strongest driver right now is that many of the models that we're getting are actually being achieved or got from scanning from some kind of a scanning technology. In other words, you'll take an object. This is a bad example because mostly you put these under lasers. You put an opaque version of this on a turntable, and you've got a laser that zips around and constructs a three-dimensional cloud of points, hundreds of thousands of points. And some poor algorithm has to come through and actually figure out an appropriate tessellation of those points into a polygonal mesh, typically a triangular mesh. And as a consequence, out of even the simplest geometry, you can get literally millions of points, and as a consequence, millions of triangles. Not all of those triangles really add much information to the overall shape. And furthermore, these technologies, like any scanning technology, are noisy. So you have a little bit of error around every one of those points. The consequence is you tend to get some populated, somewhat noisy meshes. And that's one of the reasons why we wanted to move towards signal processing. So it's extremely common. And the other thing is that there's almost no theory whatever that allows us to talk about polygonal models. They just work. And that's roughly speaking, until about 1995 or so, that's about all you could say. But you do want to ask some questions, really, about any kind of geometric representation. You want to talk about... Yeah? So you can go in a... you can write transformations. You know, something that metamorphoses for example, a curve to some discrete representation. And you can talk, for example, in some cases about the closeness of the approximation, you know, the maximal error and so on. You can talk also about tessellation techniques that allow you to go from a continuous surface. Well, every surface, every such surface is continuous, but from a higher order continuous surface to a low order continuous surface. But there's little to say about the opposite. In other words, if I have two polygonal meshes, can I talk about one being close to the other? Can I talk about one being more complex than the other? Those are the sorts of things that I'm referring to. There is an algorithmic notion of how we do this work, but there's precious little theory about things like approximation quality. It's really remarkable how little there is in that space. So we do want to talk, though, about things like what does it mean for an object to be complex? For example, the number of polygons in your representation doesn't necessarily mean that things are really complex. If I have a plane and I put up millions of coplanar polygons on that plane, I haven't got a complex surface. So we need to have ways of talking about real complexity, kind of visual complexity of surfaces. We want to talk about things like how difficult things are to render. And that's related to things like complexity, but in a very specific way. For example, we might want to talk about what the complexity of computing shadows is in various polyhedral environments. Shadow computation, as it turns out, is actually a very tricky problem. For things like point light sources, shooting a bunch of rays or effectively calculating a silhouette of a polyhedron and essentially sort of projecting it through space is a relatively straightforward thing. But even in that situation, you've got a very interesting set of intersection calculations that has to be made between that projected kind of weird frustum of this silhouette into the world intersecting other polygons or other geometry. So you can talk about the complexity and difficulty of such problems. You also want to talk about things about how smooth the representation is. As the questioner pointed out, at some point you may well have some kind of representation that might have there might be some properties in sort of the forward transformation from a curved surface to this piecewise continuous surface. But you might want to talk about how bumpy the surface is. How irregular the surface is, and so on. And again, those are the sorts of things you'd like to be able to talk about. And you'd like to also separate out what a feature of an object is from what noise in an object or noise in the representation is. A lot of these things are kind of heuristic or visually motivated kinds of properties. One of the hardest, and probably the holy grail of a considerable portion of scene analysis is how do you search for an object in a database? I want to be able to sketch a chair and say, well, find me all instances that are like that in this database. Those are really hard problems. And the most typical approach is to take what I just said, that sketch of a chair, and somehow create some kind of a signature for it. And hopefully it's effectively a compact code that I can then use to search into a database of other compact codes. That's a typical problem or a typical solution, but it doesn't necessarily mesh well with some of these other things. So these are hard questions, as it turns out, and they're hard for all surfaces. And they're hard for triangular meshes. Okay, I've got 25 minutes. So I'd like to now move into actually some recent work. I've actually never presented this stuff, so it's very recent stuff. Really motivated by some work that really started in 1995 or 1996 with Gabriel Tobin, and recently we've really built up a head of steam on I think some interesting characterizations of triangular meshes. So as I said, it's really without lots of generality that we can just look at triangular meshes. So what have we got? What we've got then with a triangular mesh is really a set of vertices dispersed in space somehow, with edges connecting those vertices such that any face is a triangle, and such that there's nice relatively regular connectivity, meaning that the connectivity is across edges. Okay, you typically do not have connectivity, just straight edge connectivity. Okay, that's less common because that becomes a point of singularity. Those become hard to render. So more typically, what happens with things like those cloud of points algorithms that I was talking about and so on is that they construct reasonable meshes. that don't have these undesirable properties. And as I said, they often, from the forward perspective, are a piecewise linear approximation of some kind of smooth surface. Now, a question that you can ask that actually wasn't being asked in computer graphics until recently is, to what extent can that triangular mesh be seen as some kind of a signal for which or to which one could apply some of the classic results and methodologies of signal processing? And in particular, is there anything like a Fourier transform of these kinds of objects? And the reason for looking at it in that way is really to get as much leverage as possible from prior results. There's nothing particularly earth-shattering about the desire for it. And of course, trying to kind of create a more regular theory, a more interesting theory that would allow triangular meshes or regular polygonal meshes to be thought of in the same way as images and one-dimensional signals such as sound, for that matter. So the other thing to say is that we, sort of by virtue of the kind of technologies that we are working with, it's more preferable to have a so-called irregular topology than a regular topology. And all that means is that the valence of these vertices can be non-constant. So typically, in a regular topology, you're looking at 3, sometimes 6, whereas in an irregular one, it's usually bounded. But you'll know it'll be greater than 2, and probably less than some reasonable number like 12. But that's the irregular setting that we're more interested in. So just to give you a sense of this, you'll notice that each of these, in fact, are scanned polygonal meshes, and they're rendered using a very straightforward rendering algorithm. And you actually, given the density of the polygons in each of these models, you can't see the polygonal facets. Okay, so just because there's an underlying polygonal representation doesn't mean that after rendering and so on, you actually see the polygonal facets underlying these visual treatments. Now, there are a couple of things, just to go back to the earlier question, there are a couple of things you can say about regular surfaces. There's some beautiful work that talks about, for example, some of the combinatorial aspects of meshes. For example, there's a Poincaré formula that just talks about the fact that the number of vertices together with the number of edges taking away the number of faces is equal to 2 minus the 2 minus 2 times the genus. So generally it's 0 for genus 1. This notion of semi-regularity, by the way, comes up in the subdivision surfaces I was talking about. Semi-regularity, it's probably quasi-regularity, makes more sense, means that you have a mostly regular surface except for a couple of positions where the valence is not constant. We're going to deal mostly with irregular meshes, and because they're the ones that seem to be harder to work with. So we thought that would be an appropriate place to start. In the regular space, it actually is just mathematically a little less interesting. So we thought, well, irregular meshes certainly subsume regular ones, so let's work with those. Yeah, and that's it. Before I go on, any other questions? Yeah. If the mesh is coming from other places, for example, from finite element methods, it's very desirable to have as regular a mesh topology as possible. Yeah, and this becomes an interesting question because for purposes of computer graphics, you may not actually care about the valence of the vertices and so on, some aspects of the geometry. But if you're sending it down the pike to some other process, you might. So there are certainly considerations where it's worth doing. The other thing to say is that you could always resample a mesh to create a regular approximation of it. It's going to be somewhat ad hoc. It's just as ad hoc as the tessellation algorithms we talked about a minute ago, but one could do it. Now, I have to say that when it comes to, we make an assumption, by the way, when we start looking at this as a this whole notion of a mesh as a signal, For us, we make a different kind of regularity assumption. It's kind of a spacing assumption that roughly speaking, the vertices in the object are roughly speaking reasonably equidistant. So that there is, in other words, there is some process that filters away clusters of points that are just kind of all on top of one another at the finest scale. If you have, you know, something else going on like this. So we want a different kind of regularity, which is tantamount to a uniform spacing in a discrete signal. But actually, that, from the point of view of the technologies that we're working with, is a pretty reasonable assumption. Did I answer your... Okay. So, other questions? Okay. So we want to view the mesh a mesh as a surface. And I think I've covered most of these things. Most of the things that we want to do in meshes really are motivated by the sorts of things that you probably already know about from day-to-day life or some of your research. We want to smooth things, we want to filter things, we want to enhance edges, whatever that might mean. We want to be able at some point to decimate, in other words, reduce the complexity of meshes, we want to compress them and send them somewhere and so on. So the motivation for these problems is exactly as you'd see in other domains. I think I'll skip that and just say that it's really just another aspect of it is that it's really nice to simply think of meshes as having as really being subject to Fourier analysis. I just mentioned earlier that the meshes are uniformly sampled signals. Okay, so as with any reasonably disciplined approach, we want to do it right. We want to do it well. We want to do it, if possible, quickly. It turns out that the middle one is the hardest part. If we use straight signal theoretic techniques, it turns out that that we end up having to solve essentially a million eigenvectors in a million point mesh. So we probably have a small problem in actually making it entirely practical, but it provides a wonderful analysis tool. So what's the start? What we start with is a set of uniformly sampled points in space. The surface is embedded as a consequence in three-dimensional space, but we're typically interested in that embedding of a two-dimensional surface in the three-dimensional volume. And so as a consequence, there's x, y, and z coordinates. You can think of just in terms of, from a discrete perspective, that the discrete signal is nothing more than the set of points in space, uniformly spaced, with kind of attached alongside it is the topology information that connects up those points in space, that cloud of points in space. Now, a lot of people have done a variety of things along the lines of treating this work, these things as signals. You'll notice that the work is relatively recent, and that's why this is the first time I'm presenting it. The idea of a full embedding of this material, these kinds of materials, these objects, into a signal theoretic framework is really new to what we're doing in our graphics lab. So I just want to say that there's a lot of stuff going on in the area right now, and I'll just in the interest of time have to skip by it. Okay. So I just want to talk a tiny bit more about where this stuff is leading. Gabriel Tobin in 95 said, well, if I take one-dimensional view of a mesh, in other words, just take, say, the X component, I can actually treat it exactly like a signal. And if I look at what I might want to do to that signal, then, in fact, the kind of displacements, the kind of operations I might want to do on that signal look an awful lot like some kind of filtering operation, and that in fact, if I look at the operation as a linear operator on those vertices, I can look at the eigenvalues or eigenvectors, eigenfunctions of that linear operator, and they actually end up looking a little like a DFT. So that's what he was talking about in 95. So this notion of an eigenvalue decomposition was introduced by him earlier, and I'll make that a tiny bit more precise in a minute. So So he stopped at the 1D sense because it was just kind of speculation. I'll talk a little bit later about that exploding sphere there because we have a better version of it. Now I want to talk about what we're actually doing with these meshes. So you're given this cloud of points, triangles kind of inferred by those cloud of points. So we have some topology information. That topology information is normally encapsulated in an adjacency matrix. So it tells you which vertices are connected to one another in an edge. And then what you typically want to do is to operate somehow on that mesh. And most of the operators actually work locally, but you can systematically talk about the simultaneous operation over the entire mesh by means of a large matrix operator. So for example, the so-called uniform Laplacian operator is built around the following thing. This little matrix, actually not so little matrix, if you have a million element polygonal mesh, this is going to be a million by million matrix. It's fairly sparse. It simply creates the average. It's an average vertex around a local region. So it's essentially a little centroid operator on its own. As it turns out, there's something called a uniform Laplacian, which is just the identity matrix minus the centroid matrix. And what it does, intuitively, is it tends to cause a shrinkage of the mesh toward the centroid of each of the vertices. So it tends to pull the vertices toward the center of each face. Notice that, however, that's happening simultaneously across a whole bunch of faces. So you get this kind of bubbling of the faces or of the edges toward kind of simultaneously toward a variety of centroids. What you as a consequence tend to get is a smoothing effect. It's almost like putting the surface under a little bit of tension and sort of pulling it a little bit tighter. And so that's what the uniform Laplacian does, and that's often iterated on a mesh to sort of effectively creates a so you take more than one pass through the mesh. What, as a consequence, one gets is this progressive relaxation and kind of this slight implosion of the surface toward these centroids. It, as a consequence, tends to smooth out some of the noise. So, the thing that the key idea here, in terms of the decomposition of these operators, is to look at what the operators do to the meshes. So we're not really that interested in the mesh itself as much as how the mesh responds to wide classes of operators on them. So each of these operators effectively cause displacements in the vertices to happen, keeping, let's assume that the topology information stays the same. So in other words, we're not changing how these vertices are connected. There's actually we actually don't assume that in the full theory, but let's assume that that's what we're doing now. So under the assumption that really we're just jiggling the vertices, an operator causes that jiggle, and what we'd like to be able to do is capture that in as compact a way as we can by looking really at the decomposition of the operator, in this case it's U, and really classes of operator like that, in terms of a set of basis eigenvectors, and these, this should be X1, I guess. And in terms of essentially spectral coefficients, x1 through xn. So what we're doing then is creating something of a transform of the mesh x. Instead of the original sequence of points x1, x2, and x3, and so on, what we're instead going to do is look at the behavior of x under this operator u as decomposed into a set of eigenvectors and spectral coefficients. Now, why is that at all useful? As it turns out, these eigenvectors themselves, if the operator is nicely behaved, these eigenvectors, if we can coerce them into being, say, orthonormal, allow us some nice ways of analyzing the properties of the surface. And furthermore, what it allows us to do is, if we want to push a filtering operation, say a polynomial rational filter, through the system, we can actually make it operate on the in this space, namely in the eigenvector space. So So the eigenvalue decomposition problem is that of computing this thing with respect to a specific operator. Yeah. No. In fact, I'm skipping now about 3 hours of discussion. We generally want to impose some properties or some conditions on U. Generally, I think symmetric positive definiteness will be enough to get us. These operators come from specific heuristic things we want to do to the mesh. Okay, so they're not. These operators aren't arbitrary kinds of operators that you might look at in an operator space. They actually refer to ways in which we might, for example, want to smooth surfaces. So there's, for example, within the literature, about a half a dozen different such U's that are interesting. There's a bunch of others, for example, that are edge enhancers, that are this or that or that. So what we've been looking at is trying to generalize the properties of those operators into something that certainly spans the existing practice, but allows us really to explore a wider set of operators. But it's not a general class of operators that you would actually normally want to work with. So yeah, we have to impose conditions on you. And once you have those conditions, surprisingly, most of the operators that are being used in graphics now are captured by those. And there's a lot of other interesting ones that one can explore. So to give you a sense, you can't see it very well, but one of the things you can do is that you can create truncated sequences, much like a discrete or much like a Fourier series. We could look at truncated sequences of these objects. By the way, I'll give you pointers to the real workup of this work. Just send me some email. But if we truncate N and look at under the operator U. The uniform Laplacian, you can actually see, this is four terms up along the top, I think this is 30 terms, and this is 50 terms of this polygonal mesh that sort of kind of comes together. I actually love this horse. I love this image. It looks like an ancient depiction of a horse. But in any case, what it is, what we're seeing there is only the first K terms of that eigenvalue decomposition. That's right. U only knows that it is a uniformly sampled mesh. All U knows is that it knows a certain topology. It knows it's a triangular mesh, and it knows that it has a set of so-called one-ring neighbors, because you have to look at the valence of the vertices. About the valence of each of the vertices on a face. Once you have that, you can compute one over that valence. That gives you the operator matrix, and then that times the adjacency matrix gives you the entire signal, the operated signal, the displaced x's and y's and z's in space. Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it. Yeah. Yeah, you can concatenate them, you can iterate them. Yeah. No, we're looking at it with this is in fact a truncated sequence of one U. Yeah, this is the this in fact is think of you can think of this as the original horse, the original sequence of well think